not used to carrying around babies anymore, so this is heavy. Good morning. It's good to be with you guys. I always love coming back, and you guys have a really big group and also a really well-supported group. I see some of the same table moms each year that I come back, so I'm grateful that all of you guys are here. Before we start, I want to try something new, really, which is I want to just pause for about 30 seconds and give you guys a chance to think of something that you're grateful for. And kind of not just like a name, like something you'd write down on a sheet of paper, but like picture it, you know, picture it, get it in your mind. It could be the beautiful fall leaves. It could be that your baby slept through the night. That might have been a miracle. But we're just going to spend 30 seconds on that and just really thinking about it. If you need to close your eyes, I'm going to be thinking about mine too. What we've learned from studies about emotional health is that gratitude is the most grounding of all emotions. So anger is the most disruptive. So when you can pause for a moment, sometimes you know, being able to breathe is nice, but when you've got, you know, a bunch of kids running around and you can't even do that, to just think of something that you're grateful for, it'll try to get you back into that present space as well. So I just wanted to make sure that we started there for myself too. So the committee got together and they asked specifically for me to speak on mom guilt. So they gave me the easy topic. And when I was talking to my husband, Carl, I was telling him, I said, yeah, I'm going to, you know, talk at UPC again. It's going to be super great. He's like, oh, what are you talking about? And I said, well, they asked me to talk about mom guilt. And he's like, oh, that's so great that they asked you to talk about something you know so much about. And I thought, that's sweet. So I do know a thing or two about mom guilt, and so we're going to go into that a little bit today, but what I want to be able to start with is the framework that I operate out of, which is the paradigm that Scripture tells us that there is no condemnation. So if you're feeling guilt, that condemnation is not coming from God. It's coming from somewhere else. So I start from that paradigm right in Romans 8:1. There is no condemnation. And then further in Galatians, it's for freedom that we've been set free. So if you're bound by mom guilt, you're probably in a kind of chains or prison. And at least the paradigm that I operate from is a high value of Scripture, which tells me that that condemnation isn't coming from God and it's not for me, and really what's intended is freedom. So hopefully we'll get you at least set on the course to something of that freedom by the time we're done. So once we operate from that, we say, well, if there is no condemnation, then why do we feel so bad? Why do we struggle with mom guilt on a daily, moment-to-moment kind of type basis? And what I want to try to get a little bit of crowdsourcing from is we're going to talk a little bit about, I kind of did this handout as a sort of matching, you know, so that as you kind of jot down the things that you feel guilty about, you can draw a line to the mom right in the center and say, yep, that's me, yep, that's me, nope, that's not me, and be able to kind of match them to what your experience is of some of these things that we're going to collectively come up with together. So I started us off with a little bit, but we're getting mom guilt because someone else is condemning us. So we want to go through the list of who is condemning us. If it's not God, it's someone else. So let's start with culture. So whether it's, you know, when my kids were little, I didn't have Instagram, and so I didn't get the kind of normalization that you see if you're following, you know, Rage Against the Minivan or MacGyvering Moms or those kinds of things. You didn't kind of get the experience of everybody goes through this. You really felt isolated and alone. And you got this message from culture that, a couple of the messages that I got is that the only good mom is the stay-at-home mom. All right, tough, right? So there's condemnation right there if you are not a stay-at-home mom. Other ones that I internalized pretty strongly were that you get it from the medical community, the health community, same thing, you must breastfeed. That's the only way to be a good mom. So if you're not breastfeeding, you're not a good mom. So again, condemnation, where's it coming from? It's coming from culture, yeah? Another thing is that if you're, in order to be a good mom, you have to sign up to be on the PTA. Thankfully, my husband did. So he was the PTA treasurer, and I got to skip that chapter altogether, luckily. But still felt guilty for not being the one who was. Even though there was somebody represented in our family doing it, I felt guilty that I wasn't the one doing it, right? So help me out. What are some other things, messages you hear in culture that say that you're a bad mom if?
So it's interesting. The stay-at-home, like you said, was the one, but I'm finding the reverse now. You know, if you're not working and helping provide for your family in this day and age, you're lazy or you're just looking for, kind of like how sometimes you go on maternity leave and your coworkers are like, oh, enjoy your vacation, okay?
Right. Right, so you get it from either side, right? It's you've got to do it all. You've got to be a stay-at-home mom and a full-time earner at the same time. Yeah. Yeah, what else? Yeah?
Not being all your kids, like events, sporting events, birthday parties,
yes.
Everything.
Yes, being completely available all the time, the cheerleader on the sidelines, making sure you're cutting oranges ahead of time to bring for everybody else to enjoy. Mm-hmm. Yeah? Guilty.
Cooking.
What else?
Cooking.
Cooking, yep. Yes, exactly. Pack lunches every day, 4-course dinner every night. It must be organic, and not just from the store. You had to grow it in your garden in the back. Yeah, even in Seattle where there's no sun, I can't grow anything. But yeah.
Getting help, I felt like so much comments like, "Oh, you're getting a babysitter. Are you back to work?"
Oh.
No, I just kind of needed to time, and you have to explain what you're doing with your time.
Yeah.
It could be very valuable. Otherwise,
yeah. Oh my goodness, that kind of breaks my heart a lot, not a little. Yep.
Both signing your kids up for camp and activities, and also not signing your kids up for camp.
Screen time is the one that I've gotten a lot of guilt on.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
oh yeah, sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But then I feel guilty because everyone's like, well, now your kid's going to be super ADHD and he's, not doing nature. You should be out at a park with him.
Well, so you're hearing it, right? You're getting the full deluge of what this sounds like. It sounds like it's really hitting home.
When your child misbehaves in public and you are getting the look of how is she going to parent?
Yes. I remember I had a part-time job at TJ Maxx and... back when I earned about $6 an hour, so this was a long time ago, right? And I remember being, before I had kids, I remember being like, my kids will never sound like that. Right, we've all been there. We've all done that. Yeah. Oh, sure. Yeah. Repeat so everybody can hear. Yeah. Yeah, I want to go back to just a second to this one, this bind of you sign your kids up for camp or you don't sign your kids up for camp, right? So this is a bind, right? It feels as if you can't win. That's why I'm always starting from the premise of there is no condemnation. It's coming from somewhere else, because even if you were to sign your kids up for camp, you're going to get it on the other side of don't sign your kids up for camp. So it's going to come back and forth all the way, and it really backs women into a kind of, it's almost like a very small square that you can stand on and feel like you can sufficiently stand there without an onslaught of some level of condemnation. So I just want to start from the premise of that condemnation isn't coming from God. So it's coming from somewhere else. So we started with culture, and I heard some of it bleed over into this next category, which is the family of origin. So some of it might have been that the culture is telling you all of these things, but also what is it like in your family of origin? Maybe it was something that your mom did really well, and so there's an expectation that you do it too. So use cloth diapers. Or sew your kids' clothes, or something like that. So let's hear a few that you can kind of trace back to, oh, it's specific not just to the culture, but to my own family of origin. I wrote down, you're supposed to love arts and crafts. You go to the Dollar Tree and you get like a few arts and crafts and you're thinking, yeah, it's going to be an arts and crafts day. And you get home and you realize that all your arts and crafts lasted 15 minutes. And you think, I would have to have this for like, I'd have to have 24 arts and crafts to make it through an entire day before my husband gets home, right? But you're supposed to like it. It's supposed to be fun. Or like, right this season, carving pumpkins. I saw on my Facebook post the other day, it was like a flashback to about 5 years ago when I was like, I'm so glad they can finally carve their own pumpkins. I don't have to do it for them. Because in my family of origin, if you aren't celebrating the holidays in that fashion, mom guilt. So anything else you guys can think of specifically for that you can trace back to your own family of origin? Yeah?
Having a nice dinner,
yeah. Home-cooked meal. Mm-hmm. Everybody sit down together, yeah? Yeah?
Yeah,
Oh, yeah.
Big deal. You gotta do it up.
Yep, yep. Pinterest worthy. That's what they need to be these days. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Doing pregnancy a certain way, grandparents and spousal opinions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, pregnancy, who's in the room at delivery, yeah, and whole kit and caboodle, yep. That's a big one. Yeah, everybody has an opinion, right? Everybody has, whether it's coming from your in-laws or it's coming from your own family of origin, it's an opinion, and then there's a pressure. Because we want to be good, and it seems like we've outsourced what's good to people outside of us, either our parents or our in-laws or the culture or what looks good on social media. We have outsourced our feelings of whether or not we're doing a good job to someone else. And so we feel that condemnation because their opinion or their situation matters, and it's of high value. So then the last aspect of it where we feel pressure too is just even from our own personalities. So we do grow up and we're situated in a specific culture, then we're also situated within a specific family of origin, but then we come out and it's the large argument of nature versus nurture, right? We come out a certain way. So we might be a perfectionist, and so we think, I didn't carve that pumpkin right, or I didn't have that great birthday party, or I didn't manage my schedule right, and some of that's on us, and we condemn ourselves. Because we didn't measure up to some sort of standard that we have just that meets our personality. So I know for me, I have this perfectionistic mindset. I'm also competitive. I want to make sure I'm doing as good as everybody else who has the same resources that I have. Another big one for me is to do it by the book. If a book says to do it, I'll try to land, like hit that mark and hit that target dead on. And that becomes problematic because I have a different baby or a different husband or a different lifestyle or different whatever, and I can't do it, but I try to do it by the book. Anyone else want to share something that they're aware of? Yeah.
I don't want to blame or shame because my mom's in this room. She always really seems to enjoy her time with me and my sister. It seemed like she genuinely loved to be around us. And I don't always feel that way about my boys.
Yeah. Yep.
And so I kind of expected as a mother that I would really enjoy my time around my kids because
right, so anytime you don't feel that,
yeah.
Both it was in your family of origin, and you're thinking, I want to enjoy the time with my
right.
kids, and you don't, maybe you're an introvert, and you don't like the extroverted nature of boys.
So, just as I'm Lauren's mom. I work at least 40 or 50 hours a week, so my time with the girls is special.
Yeah.
And I think that that's what we're talking about, is that there
you go. There you go. You guys can talk about that over a four-course meal that one of you guys cooked together. Yeah. Right, so then you find yourself getting angry and you think you're doing it wrong because the people who raised you didn't do it that way. So it's always this comparison game. There's some kind of standard, some kind of obligation, some kind of pressure, and if we don't reach it, that's where all this guilt is coming from. But the standard is movable. It's like trying to hit a moving target. You do it, you don't do it. We're going to find out in 10, you know, wouldn't it be crazy if we found out in 10 years that breastfeeding is bad or something like that? I mean, I don't think that'll happen, right? But I mean, wouldn't it be wild? Like, you think you're doing all of this stuff and then you find out, oh no, it's not good, right? The target is always moving. So we have to find a new target. Otherwise, there will always be that felt sense of condemnation. So we're going to talk about what that target will be in a minute. So then the one that I want to spend a little bit of time on that gets kind of personal, and so I'm not going to ask you guys to share because I think this is where it hits home, where it sort of differs from guilt, meaning there's someone else's standard and we don't reach it. That's kind of a guilty, that's where the condemnation comes from. But I think what happens too is when we have our own standard, which may not even have to do with our personality, but might have to do with something we really want. We want to be loving and kind. We want to be present. We want to care. And then when we don't do those things that we really want to do that are influenced by outside factors, but there's choices that we're making and we can't live up to those choices and those standards, and then there's some kind of harm as a result, that's where shame kicks in. Shame then becomes not just that you're doing it wrong, but you are wrong.
So it's a movement that goes one layer deep. And so I just want to share a little bit about, from my own experience, a really shameful experience that I have of my own daughter, and hopefully to just get you guys to be thinking about your own, because sometimes it's this sort of invisible force that's driving the whole car. It's like we feel ashamed about something that we want to do, we couldn't do, there's been some kind of harm, so then we try to meet all these external standards instead. So we spend a lot of time trying to make sure that we have the Pinterest parties and that we cook and that we do all of these things, but ultimately what it boils down to is it's all kind of a cover story for this reality that we're trying to do something. There's been hurt or harm or something that we're trying to contend with. And so for me, I've been here a lot, so I've told this story probably plenty of times, but when my daughter was born, I had postpartum depression for about 11 months. And during that time, I was completely vacant emotionally. So the attachment that I had with my daughter was ruptured from the very beginning. And what ended up happening was that over the course of that first year, it really settled us into a pattern of disconnection, a pattern of lack of attachment, and a pattern of non-emotional relating. And so it wasn't until she was about 3 that I kind of saw the behavioral manifestations of that and knew enough to go get help. And that began my therapeutic journey, which ultimately led me out here to Washington to go to school to learn how to do it myself and for others. So during that first year, what was so hard for me, probably the hardest part about the whole year, was she never slept. So all night long, I'd be fighting with for maybe 2 hours or maybe 3 hours or trying to string together a certain amount of time. And I just, by the time the morning came and 6 a.m., you know, babies wake up and they're ding, ready for the day. It didn't matter how many darkening blinds I put on. It didn't matter the noise machine, the whatever. It didn't matter. She would wake up at 6 a.m. And I had just been struggling all night and I could not get up in the morning. I just couldn't wake up and go get her. So the picture that I have in my mind that I have a lot of shame about, where there was harm done, is that I wanted to be present to her. I wanted to be present to her in ways that maybe I wasn't present, somebody wasn't present to with me when I was younger. I wanted to be that. It was something that I wanted, but I couldn't. I didn't have it. So I'd go into her room. I'd either give her a bottle and hope that she went back to sleep. I'd dump a bunch of toys in her crib. And then I'd go and I'd crawl back in bed with a blanket over my head for as long as I possibly could before I had to get up for the day. And what was really hard about that is that she learned, in a sense, that to feel things like abandonment, not wanted, not cared about, ignored, those kinds of things that I would never want her to feel. Those are things that I knew what those felt like, and I didn't want her to feel that way. And there was a result of that. There was a breach in our relationship. Not only that behavior, all the emotional availability, but there was a breach in that, specifically because of that time. That's what I hold in my head as one of the things that I would go back and change if I could. And so to recognize that the standard may have come from culture, you know, that you wake up in the morning, it's like every cereal commercial on the planet is like, ding, you've got your Folgers and you're, you know, eating cereal at the table with orange juice and, you know, a full cooked meal. So it could be culture. Could be my own family of origin, the way that my mom would come into my room and sort of say, you're going to sleep the day away, kind of like get up and get going. It could come from that. Could come from my personality of wanting to sort of master the day, you know, like get up and be like, I got this thing, you know. But really what it boils down to is I had a heart to connect with my daughter and I couldn't. And that's where shame creeps in, because it says, well, if you wanted something and you couldn't give it, then you must be terrible. There must be something wrong with you. So what do we do when that gets its roots in us? What do we do when that sort of digs in? You know, we've kind of figured out, you know, we can be aware of the other things, but once shame kind of grips down there, it ends up being the sort of rudder that drives the rest of your behaviors. Well, what I want to just say is that I honestly believe that let's put it this way. I wouldn't be here and I wouldn't be able to speak if I didn't believe in the core theme of all of Scripture, which is that redemption is possible. Maybe not this side of heaven, but it is the goal of all of Scripture, is to take what is garbage and bad and ashes and turn it into something beautiful. That's the theme that runs from Genesis to Revelation through the whole entire book. And so I didn't know that at the time when I was in this postpartum depression. I've had to learn it since, which is why I'm so grateful to be able to share it with you. But that is God's intent. is that nothing is outside of taking those ashes, that shame, those failures, and turning it into something powerful and beautiful. And so that is what happened to me, is that, like I said, that whole year I wasn't aware of the harm. I knew I felt shame over it. I wasn't aware of the result of it. After about 3 years, went to counseling and started to understand how to rebuild attachment, kind of try to understand what went wrong. Why couldn't I get up in the morning? What were the factors that of why I was depressed? And I started understanding a little bit more about that. I kind of had to take a look at my whole story and see how it was a sort of generational thing as well. What were the pressures that I was going through at the time? So I took a look at all of that. But what I want to end with that vignette is that, so my daughter's 15 now. I started this quest to rebuild our attachment when she was 3. And so when she was about 10, I guess, is when she started junior high. And out here in Seattle, junior high starts at like 7:30. It did. It started at 7:30 in the morning. So she had just moved into a room downstairs. And so I just thought to myself, a 10-year-old had to wake up at like 6 a.m. to get ready to go to school when it's still dark out and cold. But in that time, between the time she was 3 and the time she was 10, I was able to get what I needed. I was able to get healing. I was able to get support. I was able to ask for my needs to be met. I was able to, thank God, she was sleeping through the night, although I swear it didn't happen until she was 8 years old. So there were things that I had. I had more resources at that point. So by the time she was 10, I thought to myself, okay, she has to get up for junior high. It's a big transition, you know, going to 6th grade and junior high. She has to get up early. Peter, my son, doesn't even need to get up because he's going to elementary school, and they don't even start till like 8:39, so he doesn't even need to be awake. So I thought to myself, what's a nice way to wake up? You know, to an alarm clock, you know, beep, 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 beep. And I thought, no, I want to be able to be with her when she wakes up. So what I was able to do is set my alarm for earlier. I had what I needed, so I was able to wake up. I was able to go down into her room, crawl under her covers. She was so warm. And crawl under her covers and snuggle with her for 15, 20 minutes before she woke up on her own. And that was my redemption. So what ended up happening from that point in junior high, she had a really hard time transitioning. So she still woke up crying for school. She still woke up not wanting, you know, to face the day. And I could have easily collapsed into that place of like, I can't deal with it, just get up and go. But I had more of what I needed, so I was able to give her what she needed and able to help her transition during that time. But 7 years, you know, from the time, well really 10, from the time she was born until 10 years old was I able. So redemption is a long game. This isn't a quick turnover, but it is possible, but it is a long game. And so what I want to just sort of reflect on with you is that the things that we have guilt over, I want to kind of walk you through the 1, 2, and 3 step on this right side of the sheet of where I would begin kind of tackling this work. So if you're with me and you believe that redemption is possible, if that story is compelling enough to say that it may take some time, but it is possible, and that that's always God's intent, but it is a long game, one of the first things that you can do for 1 is just be aware of the pain. Be aware of your pain, your kid's pain. Be aware of what hurts. And that is so much easier said than done, because we don't want to look at pain. Because if we look at the pain or the hurt of our kids, it goes right back to our shame. We did that, right? So it's really hard to look at the pain. But where is the pain? It might be in kids' behaviors. It might be in your own attitude towards your spouse or your parenting. Where is the pain? Just take a look at it. Where does it hurt? Where does it hurt to be a mom? Where do you feel isolated? Where do you feel alone? Where do you feel like it's beyond what you can do? You don't have the resources. You don't have what you need. Just take a look at the pain first. So I kind of paired them on the side of the handout. So be aware of you. Be aware of your pain. Be aware of it. The second one is go back to your family of origin and learn your story. Where do these kinds of pains, where are they generational? Where are they in the flow of a pattern where, hey, ask your mom. You know, mom, like she just said, I enjoyed my kids, but it's because I worked. So that's a different framework. It opens up space to go, when you're with them all day, you might not enjoy them or don't expect to enjoy them, you know? Know your story. Know where this comes from. For me, I think I have a lot of pain and shame, particularly around that kind of isolation that I felt Lucy experienced and that abandonment, because it's something in my own story. So it hurt even worse that I couldn't control for it.
it's always like happening again. So know your story, know something of where the guilt comes from, where the shame comes from, where was it with your parents, where was it with, in your history, even grandparents. I'm finding things in my story that really have so much to do with even really something that happened to my grandmother. So know your story, investigate your story, tell your story. And then the last one is I want to move all the way up to this idea of culture, is that really to begin mobilizing or moving your experience of guilt as being from your own kind of grandiosity. So if you want to put the word grandiosity, move away from grandiosity. There are things that you have impact on, but it's also not all about you. There, you come in, you live in a certain time, in a certain place, in a certain culture that is influencing lots of things that have to do with your parenting and your kids. So in some sense, to begin displacing some of this guilt and shame on a culture, on a community, on a place, a demographic where you live, to begin just kind of going, you know what? Screen time is a good example. I don't think any of us could be exempt from screen pressures right now. You know? I don't know how it's possible. Everything's on my phone. So that's the time, that's the age, that's the culture that we live in. So to think that you could be above screen times is a form of grandiosity. We all try to imagine that we could because we hear of the effects of it and we know that it causes rupture in our own relationships and things like that. I had to finally just literally, I'm on Instagram, right? And I'm in the bathtub and I'm like looking at Instagram and I'm scrolling. So then I use my media to text my husband to say, come get me out, I can't stop. It's like this vortex that sucks you in, right? But even at that point, I knew I couldn't do it. I needed some help. Please, come take it away from me. Now help me out. You know what I mean? So to begin kind of thinking that you can do as much as you can do, and there's going to be a place where you can't have impact there. It's too big. It's too powerful. It's in the culture that you're in. So to begin displacing some of this so that it doesn't hit straight as all about you. So we do need to do our work. We do need to be aware of our own shame, our own pains, the things that we're trying to cover up. We need to recognize that it comes in a family and that we've been grown in that atmosphere. And that also our family was grown in an atmosphere. And to begin taking some of that into context so that it displaces all of the responsibility falling squarely on your shoulders. Because as you said, you're in a bind. It's going to be hard to win one way or the other. So instead of landing with that external drive of whether or not I'm being condemned, to shift it from going, that's a factor. It is a factor. All of these are just factors. To begin looking at the whole picture. So I want to just read. I put it on the back of the sheet, but I want to just go ahead and read it, is because it's from Brené Brown, and I think it's pretty powerful. So she's in her talk on listening to shame. She describes how shame gets organized, specifically gendered. So what does shame look like for men? What does shame look like for women? And this is what she says with the women. This is what we fail against. I can put the wash on the line, pack the lunches, hand out the kisses, and be at work at 5 to 9. I can bring home the bacon, fry it up in the pan, and never let you forget you're a man. For a woman, shame is do it all, do it perfectly, and never let them see you sweat. That is an impossible thing that comes from culture, the culture of our family of origin, and from the pressures that we put on ourselves. So it's coming from outside again, the view that there is no condemnation. I firmly believe we're all doing the very best that we can. And sometimes the best still means that there is suffering and there is pain. And that's why God puts this huge caveat of redemption in the story and says, yeah, but me, I can do something with this. I can make this, I can turn this into something. So that was fast, a lot faster than I thought it was going to be. So I just want to open up for questions for just a few minutes, and then you guys will have time at your table to talk more and answer more of these questions. I always get a little bit sensitive around things like shame and opening it up to large groups just because it's tender and it's sensitive, and not everybody probably needs to hear it, but people at your table or people that you're close with can. So. But I would like, if you have any questions about the content, I'd like to be able to answer those for you. Yeah?
If we're able to identify some of these issues in ourselves, what are the best steps toward
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you're asking a therapist what to do, which would be to go to therapy. That would be my first. That would be my first.
Yeah.
But I'm glad that you asked it, because it actually speaks to something that I wanted to make sure that I said, which is that most of the time, you cannot do this without someone else. It's too painful. I couldn't come to the realization of what had been happening between Lucy and I. I could see the behaviors, and I could see that there was something off, but I couldn't engage my part in what that was all about on my own. It's just too hard. That's why we do all kinds of things to not feel those things, because it's just too hard to feel by yourself. So the way that I think about, when I think about therapy or getting to someone that you respect and that can really go with you to those places, is that basically if you take shame and you split it between two people, now you have what was once concentrated diluted. So I think that's why, for the most part, this is really hard to do alone. So the way that the process, at least therapeutically, works is that, you know, you're sitting with someone else who is listening to the guilty things. I'm guilty of X, Y, and Z. They come and they say that. And then the therapist is listening to what is that being informed by? Family of origin, culture, self. You're listening to where it is so that you can begin locating it. And then you can begin talking about it in a way that says, okay, let's locate that, is that that's not, like, for instance, in this situation, you're saying, you know, my mom always enjoyed spending time with the kids, but I didn't. And then we begin to ask her, and she says, that's because I didn't get to spend as much time with you. And you're like, oh, now I have a choice to go, oh, that I don't have to look like my mom did, because I don't have the life that my mom did. So I have room now to be different. Now there's choice. When you're unaware of these things, they feel prescriptive. You have to be happy. You have to have food on the table. You have to cook. You have to, you know, love arts and crafts. They feel prescribed. When you start becoming aware of it, then you get choice. And you get to go, is that true? Maybe not. Maybe I don't have to live that way. Maybe I don't have to do that. You start looking for and being open to other ideas. You start listening for, oh, I wonder about this blog of this mom who says that maybe she has a really hard time with boys and doesn't like it. I'm open to that now because I have choice. It doesn't have to be prescribed. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, any other questions? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Yes, I do know the answer to that question. Okay, so, sorry, I'll repeat the question. So the question was, what if I could say what's one thing that helped me move towards repairing the relationship that I had with my daughter after this ruptured attachment? Is that what you said?
Yeah.
Okay. So glad you asked that question, because I could talk about this all day long. Touch. Touch was the key to that repair. So what happened is, I knew that, again, I kind of saw these behaviors. I go to therapy. I start understanding a little bit about where they came from. And then I stumble upon this book, like knowing I wanted connection, but I didn't know how. So I go, like I said, I do it by the book, right? So I go to the Barnes & Noble, and I'm looking for a book. And I pull out this book that's called, and you can write this one down. I should have put it down here. It's called I Love You Rituals. That's the name of the book. And I pull out this book. And I open up the front page of the book, and I start reading the introduction. And the woman says the reason why kids, whether it's patty cake or peekaboo, it's ritualistic and it's how kids learn. But what she did is she said the reason why these rituals are important, but she goes into this really deep explanation of touch, about how kids connect, learn, and grow through touch, not words. So we are in a super highly verbal society, right? So we kind of expect our kids to talk, we talk to them, we, you know, do a lot of language things that we almost bypass touch. And yet touch is the most, like, it's literally by touching your kids, you're growing their brain. So I read that introduction and I was like, that feels about like the extent of what I can do. So she would be sitting there watching Curious George. And I would sit down. We even got a pull-out couch for this reason, like one of the kinds that rolls out into a bed or whatever. And I would be sitting on the couch, and she'd be watching Curious George, and I would just start rubbing her back. You know? It was all I could do. I didn't have much more emotional capacity than that. I didn't have the playful capacity. I didn't have the energy for that kind of thing, but I just started touching. And then this really powerful moment happened when
She was probably maybe, I want to say four, so maybe like a year and a half later. Again, redemption is a long game, but you see, start seeing fruits, which I think is cool. So then about a year later, I'm running down. I'm getting ready to have a bunch of girls from church over to my house for like a community group. And this is where the pressure of culture comes in, is that everybody in my group, for whatever reason, thought that everybody had to look like Martha Stewart. So the house had to be clean from like top to bottom. And so I'm running around cleaning like crazy. My daughter gets up from her quiet time. She's sitting on the couch watching Curious George. I've got like my gloves on, you know, and I'm finishing off the last little bit in the sink, in the kitchen. I'm like, I just got to comment this kitchen and then I'll be about done. I got it all done. And I hear her call from the other room and she goes, "Mommy, I think I need some love."
Aww.
Right? I wish the story ended there. Okay, so then I was like, you know, I pull up with the gloves, I slap them down, I run in there and I go, and then I kind of sneak away, I go back into the kitchen, I put on the gloves again, and I'm just like, I just got to finish. "Mommy, I think I need more love." You know, put on, sit there, you know, and go like this. Like in a year's time, she learned that that's what I could give her. So love for her meant that. It didn't mean play. Like another kid's is going to be different. It's going to be play with me or snuggle with me before bed or sing me a song or get in the bathtub with me. Another kid's is going to be different. That was hers because that's all I could give her. And so I look back on that time, and even now when I said I wish that wasn't how the story ended, is I realize as I'm telling it, I have more of a spirit of gratitude now than I've had in the past. Mostly it's been shame that I didn't sit there longer. But now throughout, I'm able to see it was enough. It was what I could do at the time, and it was enough, and it was healing. So now I go to try to, she's 15. Number one, I can't give her a hug because it messes up her hair, right? So I go to give her a hug, and she's like, she'll go like this. I'm like, this is so awkward. She'll go like this. And she'll say, it messes up my hair. And I'll be like, why don't you let me touch you? And she's like, you did so much when I was a kid. Again, more fruit, right? So this is, I just love this story. I'll tell it because it's just fun. So she was driving, it ties in screen time too. Okay, so we're driving. I'm driving her way down south, someplace in Burien, and to go, she plays Ultimate Frisbee, so to go to a camp or something like that. And we're driving down there, and she's on, getting ready to be on her phone, like text somebody or whatever. And I said, no phones in the car, because that's the one rule that we do have, no phones in the car, right? So I said, put your phone away. And she's like, let me just finish texting. And I'm like, no, put your phone away. And I go, if you don't put your phone away, you're going to have to hold my hand the whole way down there. So she puts her phone away, right? So we get down there, and she gets done from the practice or whatever, and she gets back in the car, and she wants to text somebody a picture of the practice or whatever. So she's texting like this, right? And I was like, Lucy, you're going to have to hold my hand the whole way back, which is like a 35-minute drive, right? And I'm like, the whole way back if you don't stop. And she's like, so I proceeded to hold her hand the whole way back home, and she's like, really? And I was like, really? Really? It was the way that I could connect, and it was the only thing I had energy for at the time, and so it's now built this thread and this foundation. So that's how I started. Yeah. Yeah. Any other questions? Yeah. You know, I think we lead best by example. I think, you know, if people see the fruits of, like if you've benefited from therapy and people see the fruits of that, that's what has the most impact. Trying to point and direct people, I don't think works. And I also, because I believe in redemption, sometimes the pain has to get bad. It has to become ash-like in order to be able to be buried and grown into something great. And that's hard to watch.
But I think that everybody has to come to it at their own time and in their own way. But what I found, even in my own journey, is because I have friends that saw the same thing. They saw this rupture and they see it now. And so I think me just modeling it has had the greatest impact. Yeah.
And I can pray for her.
What's that?
I said, and I can pray for her.
Yeah, of course. Absolutely. Yes, let's not forget that. Everybody, I love the passage, I think it's in Ephesians, it says, bear one another's burdens, yes, but everyone has their own burden to bear. And sometimes these fall in that camp. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Was there a question? Yeah. I do know what you mean.
I tried not to get specific, but I didn't. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, now let me just think through it so I can give you a well-thought answer.
Therapy.
Always, always a recommendation. But let me just break it down to what it would look like in therapy. Because... Yes, repeat the question. The question was, when you know your family of origin, they have a kind of habit there that you find yourself doing. You don't want to do it, but you keep doing it. How do you begin shifting that habit? So therapy, it really functions in a sense that my goal would be to understand that anger. So first just like understand it, almost like without judgment. You know, you tell me you yelled at your kids, and I say, yeah. And then I go, what was it about? And I start understanding the layers. Well, it was about this pressure that I was feeling here, and then this support that I didn't have there. And then when this happened, that happened there. And I start peeling all the way back, and I go, makes sense to me. So that you have an experience of someone who's not judging you for it, understanding the layers behind it, and then being able to tend to what was needed back here that led to getting angry up here. So I think even in family of origin, my question would be, what needs weren't getting met before the yelling? That's what I'd be looking at. So there's layers, right? And that just involves telling somebody the story, right? So that goes back to learning your story. So it's hearing about it. But the other thing that I kind of operate under is that every behavior has a reason. It's coming from somewhere. There's a need. It's either a need's not getting met, or it has a reason. There's something not happening before the behavior. So I just always assume and think, what's happening here that's leading to this there? So not being judged for it is one place. Then being able to ask the question of where it comes from is another. And then being able to do this untangling work, which is to begin untangling the shame that you have about what's back here. A lot of times for women, it's like what you said, asking for help. That's a hard one. Feeling like you're in this thing by yourself and you have to get it right all the time. That's a lot of pressure. I just always think, man, if I'm yelling about something, something's gotten tripped up. Something's gotten tripped up. There's a reason for it, I guess, is what I mean. It makes sense to me once I hear what it's about. Yeah. Yeah, I think what's more helpful, yeah, exactly. I think what's more helpful when you're having that kind of, like what I wish somebody would have said to me
you know, when they're saying you feel like, you know, you can't be there for your daughter when she wakes up in the morning, and they would have said something like, why can't you, what's happening? And I would say, well, I don't sleep at all, and I'm depressed. Then, and they were able to say, oh, let's work on that. As opposed to, oh, you just need to be a better mom. You just need to pull yourself up by your bootstraps and get out of bed in the morning. I would have said, let's get resources here to the need. But again, this quote says that women aren't supposed to have needs. We're not supposed to need help. We're not supposed to need time away. We're supposed to be able to do it all with a smile on our face and without sweating. So to begin just cracking that open, to begin, so even with the yelling or whatever, to be the first question, go, huh, I wonder what's needed here. With a breath of kindness. But again, that's something that only you can get from someone else. And when somebody said something, oh, paying, like I don't want to pay somebody to do this for me, in the culture that we live in, I'm finding that's virtually the only way we can get it. We live in fractured communities, families all across the country, broken relationships left and right, people who want to fix it because we're in an instant culture. So to have someone actually sit with you, hear the whole story, and bear what's going on without jumping to fixing it or dismissing it, I think might be the only way to do that is in therapy. Obviously, because I'm a therapist. Yeah.
And otherwise, it's kind of like, would anyone even notice me if I were gone?
Mm-hmm.
And is there, I mean, if you got a lot of your sense of self from your job before, and then that's gone, do you have some strategies too for people who are feeling sort of like they've lost themselves?
Yeah. Did everybody hear that question? Okay, so basically the question, I think, if I could summarize it, would be, you know, if you used to work and get a lot of feedback about who you are and what you're doing well, and then you stay at home and you don't get that from two-year-olds and infants, you get the opposite. Is there something that you can do in that interim, basically? So first of all, I just want to say again, I'm angry that our culture really does isolate moms, that we're supposed to be dentists and doctors and PE teachers and nurses and all of those kinds of things for other people. So I'm frustrated about that. But what came to mind, what jumped to my mind, have any of you guys read the book The Red Tent? So nothing of its historical whatever, but the fact that in biblical times you have women who are sharing responsibilities, right? So you have a community of women who are able to reflect back to one another, thank you so much for cooking while I'm over here knitting, while they're over there playing with the kids, and they're over there getting dinner ready, or whatever, you know? You see difference coming together with a kind of unity to get a thing accomplished. We don't have that. We have moms who are usually individual at their home being expected to do all of those things because we've been told this lie that we've got to do it all without it and make it look effortless. So we don't ask for the help to get to create a kind of community that could say, let's do something about this. So that's what work generally provides. When you go into an office, you're usually a part of a team. You have a kind of role, you know, like if I was a graphic designer, I have the role of doing this. Someone else is going to market it. Someone else is going to pitch the idea. Someone else is going to be in sales. Someone else is going to be on a project manager. I'm going to sit in a conference room with all this difference. My particularity is going to be valued as a part of a greater team. I think that if we're not functioning with a kind of particularity as a part of a whole, so if you don't get that, like maybe in your marriages, you know, you feel like you're divided and divide and conquer instead of I'm good at this and I'm good at this and together we make this happen, that kind of type thing, you're going to feel a lack of belonging, and feeling a place of belonging is one of the top five human needs. So you think you're supposed to belong to your kids, but they're nonverbal. They're not reflecting back your particularity. They're not saying, let's go team. They're not saying, I can't do it without you. So we don't get what we actually need. So we're designed to function as a unit. I think that's the garden, right? It's not good for man to be alone. We need difference. Here's some difference. And we also need you to function as a unit. So if that's not happening, well, A, it's not happening. That's what makes me angry. This is an attempt to do something like that, to come together, to share your different stories, different questions, and yet all together on a quest to do right by your children. So that's why I'm glad to come here. I'm glad to see what you guys are doing, and I want to encourage you to keep doing it because it's needed. It's necessary. Everybody needs this kind of community. We're not meant to do it alone. And there's all kinds of reasons why we don't ask for help and join up with groups. But let me just tell you, just as a therapist alone, to do the work that I do is pretty individual, right? Like, it's me in a room with other people, right? There's not a kind of team, again, that kind of team labor. But my two colleagues are over here with me. They're a part of a cohort. They're a part of a group that I'm a part of. I'm a part of another consult group on Fridays. I speak on the phone with another clinician each week. I go to my own therapy. I mean, I have to go find my team. And I have. And so I meet with those team members. I meet with a different team member probably every day out of the week. So that's more, you know, it sounds like more work. You're like, oh, God, I can't plan another play date, or I can't do this, or whatever. And there's all kinds of reasons for that. But I just want to say it can be available, but it does take work. And it's also necessary. So I'll end on that because I just referenced my colleagues over there. So we are a part of an exciting new collaborative, which is called Hive and Honeycomb. And we are attempting to bring counseling to more people. As I've been doing this over the course of the last 7 years, it's hard for me to field and take all of the referrals that come directly to me. And so I've been able to get them out to my other colleagues. But now I have a direct place to get them to. And so we have, there's a group of, 10 of us total, so 10 in our group that are seeing people. And so I just want to give you a little PSA when it comes to therapy. So our information's right down there. Couple things that, again, are systemic that feel like if you don't factor in the systemic, you'll be beating your head against the wall all day long. Insurance companies are hard to work for. Hard to work for as a clinician, hard to work for as a person, somebody who has the insurance companies. A lot of times they don't have enough therapists, they don't panel enough therapists. There aren't enough of us that'll let us get on to take Primera or to take Regents or to take whatever. They don't let everybody do that. So there's limited therapists on these panels. That's one reason. The second thing is everybody after Obamacare pretty much has insurance or has to have insurance, and insurance now has to cover mental health. So why would you pay out of pocket? Doesn't make much sense if you have insurance. So you want to go find someone who takes your insurance so that you don't have to pay out of pocket, which seems sensical. Yet all of the people that you ask are either full or don't take your insurance. See this cyclical, binds all over the place, right? So what I want to encourage you to do is and I didn't write these down, I wish I would have, but there's two places. So Hive and Honeycomb is one. See if we can work with you and whatever insurance and time and all those kinds of things. The other thing is a group called Mindful Therapy Group. They have several locations, and they have a lot of clinicians, and they take almost all insurance companies. So Mindful Therapy Group is another place to look. And the other one is, if you go to psychologytoday.com, you can look up therapists by zip code, religious affiliation, and insurance provider. And it'll narrow down to, there's usually, for everybody I've ever looked for a referral, there's usually 5 to 7 people. 5 of those 7 are probably going to be full. So keep looking. I just want to tell you the state that we're in, but to also not discourage you, there are people who want to help. It's hard to get. Which I think is actually a colossal act of evil, and we're combating it just by being here today. All right, with that, blessings to you. Thank you so much for having me.
As always, thank you, Krista. We appreciate having you. I'm getting as bad as Kimberly. I just appear with babies, so.